Jameson Locke. Good afternoon.
Hi, Zach.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Well, it was awfully convenient, so I decided to drop.
Yeah, well, the perks of being coworkers. So we're going to do a little something different this episode and not talk so much about Bitcoin. We'll get to it. But the context of this and what we've been planning is really to talk about the history of email, right? That was your work before Bitcoin and how it got to the, I think you used like abomination or how it got to the state that it is today. So maybe just start off like explaining what is email on the most basic sense and what is the email protocol? How are they different?
Right. So, you know, when we talk about email as a protocol, we're specifically talking about SMTP, which is a simple mail transfer protocol. And, you know, this thing has been around for decades. You know, it wasn't really popularized, I guess, until AOL in the 90s. And then, of course, it has really gone mainstream and billions of people are using email on a daily basis. But it has a very long, storied, complex history. And the sort of the nature of email has changed a lot over time. And so if you want, we can just start at the very beginning where things were simple and then talk about the layers of complexity that have arisen.
Yeah, let's start there. So like, what was the early days of email like? Because most of everyone listening is probably not privy to that. Most people use the Gmail and stuff of today.
Yeah, you know, the very first iterations, I believe, were actually used on ARPANET. So this was the predecessor to what we consider to be the internet, the World Wide Web, as it is today, that really became a thing in the early to mid 90s. And so back then, ARPANET was really a series of like military and academic installations that were on this very early internet. You know, it was very intensive to get on to ARPANET. And it was a very small community. Pretty much everybody knew each other. And it was a very gracious community. Like, you know, it was a bunch of nerds who were willing to help each other out because they saw the potential of this new thing. And they basically wanted to help bootstrap it.
ARPANET, meaning the, what does that stand for?
I don't even really know what the acronym is.
it's so long since used.
Yeah.
So it was a sort of fringe thing in the early days of email. A bunch of nerds working on this protocol, as you said. And how did it get to the? I mean, how did it get to the? You know, we use it for everything today in critical communications. What happened that it evolved so quickly and so differently?
Yeah, well, you know, it was like a lot of technologies, you know, it evolved very slowly and then it evolved very suddenly. And so, you know, for the first few decades, it was very slow and there was not a whole lot of innovation or even you know, people trying to break it or abusing it. Really, the first abuse of it or the first notion of a spam email, I think was in the 1980s, and it was basically one sales guy, and I forget what he was.
He was selling
some enterprise software or something, and he sent out a spam email to basically the entire internet at the time.
Wow.
And it got a lot of backlash, and enough backlash that really nobody tried to send spam emails for probably another 10, 15 years, you know, until the internet started going mainstream again. But according to him, he made something like $13 million in sales from that one email.
Because spam was effective back then, because you really...
He was the only one. There's no competition.
And so why... I mean, was it something to do with spam that made people not run their own mail? Or like, why don't people run their own mail servers like they run Bitcoin nodes today?
Yeah, now that is the really long, you know, complex question of, you know, what changed over the years. I mean, the simple answer is, you know, asking anyone to run any sort of 24/7 service is kind of an operational task,
right,
that I think is generally going to be relegated to the nerds, because, you know, it requires ongoing resources and maintenance and the willingness to maintain something so that it's, you know, it has uptime, it's always responsive, because know, when you're talking about internet protocols, generally, you know, this is a dynamic thing where two computers are talking to each other. And so if one computer is not responding correctly, then it's broken.
There's a problem.
It's, yeah.
Right.
So, you know, what happened? You know, not a lot happened until AOL came along. And
when was that? Like roughly?
Yeah, early, mid-90s.
Okay.
So, you know, before that, it was very limited. You know, unless you were some sort of academic or military researcher, you probably didn't have access to ARPANET. But AOL came along, and then the sort of commercial internet as we know it, and you know, all the other ISPs came along, and now suddenly anybody who had a phone line could be connected to the internet. And so all of these ISPs naturally started offering email as one of their core services. You know, way back then, the World Wide Web, when you know commercial internet was a thing, it was so tiny. So I would argue that email was probably more interesting and valuable to people in the very early days of the internet than the actual World Wide Web.
Than the web pages.
Yeah, because now, you know, you could instantly talk to anyone else who was also on that network. Now, as soon as that happened, other salespeople realized this is a new sales channel that has basically zero cost to reach millions of people.
And no competition either.
Right. And so the you know the nature of email or of the SMTP protocol is actually rooted in reliability. So it's all about being able to send a message and be very, very confident that that message will get to the intended recipient. And you know this is the same way that the internet itself was architected, right? It was meant to be a way to pass messages around the world, even in the case of, you know, nuclear war, where there is massive devastation.
Is that like how UDP? Because I've seen the memes where like UDP just sends the message, doesn't wait for confirmation.
Yeah, it's a different type of protocol.
Okay.
You know, there's so many different internet protocols out there, and they all have different pros and cons and trade-offs and whatnot.
So, well, what was it about AOL? Because you said like it was pretty niche until AOL came on the scene, and then it became like commercialized, and people started all kinds of salespeople from all kinds of companies started using email. So, what did AOL have some particular breakthrough or product or just good user experience? Like, why was it that moment that led to that, you know, explosion of new users on the internet and mail protocol?
Right. So before the 90s, you know, like I said, it was mostly military and academic installations that were running email servers. In the early 90s, we started to see corporations start to do it because, you know, at the enterprise level, you would have full-time nerds who could, you know, manage that infrastructure. And then within a few years, the commercialization of, you know, the retail users and these other enterprises that started offering email, you know, not just for their own internal employees, but for any subscriber to their service. Mm. That's when you saw the hockey stick growth of like, you know, total number of email users.
So before that, it was just like your company email address. There was no mail as a service that any end user could just sign up for.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes sense. Like I have my like Zach at Casa. It's like most emails like the company related, but at that point, like the having it like at Gmail or at AOL, that was the sort of breakthrough where you could use these other people's mail domain names.
In terms of mainstream adoption, now in terms of like the technical way that the email servers were operating, like I said, they were all focused on reliability. So the early days, these email servers would actually, they would not only accept email like for your own corporation, but they would often do something called acting as an open relay, where they would accept email for almost anything and then try to forward on that message, you know, basically the same way the internet itself works with like routing messages.
Right.
So this was like one of the first things that really got abused is that the spammers, even possibly before AOL, the spammers realized, oh, there's these corporate networks out there, and there are thousands and thousands of end user inboxes that I can reach. you know, by sending one message to the main email server for this corporation, it'll go to thousands of people. And then basically that same tactic got magnified orders of magnitude when the retail, you know, and commercialization of the internet came along.
And so did people, they did, I guess they just didn't have the, like your everyday end user, was it easier? Was it more reliable to get mail? Because you think you said like one of the most critical parts was the certainty of deliverability of the message, right? So was it that, is it too technical, out of reach, or maybe a combination of both, and why that occurred?
So the reliability, you know, that was the main valuable aspect. You know, it's the instant transportation and communication, and the reliability that that would happen was why email adoption was so effective. But it was also what resulted in the spam being highly adopted and being effective as a marketing tool.
Because there was a single point to spam.
Yeah. It greatly decreased the cost, you know, of reaching people. And so what happened was the costs started to be imposed upon the email server operators. So when the spammers started getting onto these networks and, you know, sending messages to thousands of people, the email operators at the corporations and at the ISPs, they started seeing their servers, you know, slow down, crash, just have massive spikes in volume of what was being processed. And, you know, they were getting lots of complaints from the users as well. And so they were the ones who were faced with this problem. So essentially, you know, the onus of this problem of spam was on the recipient side. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a one-sided problem. Like the spammer could just blast out stuff and be fairly reliable that their messages were going to get to the intended destination. So it was this sort of asymmetry that started causing problems and started really pushing forward the evolution of what resulted in email becoming very different.
So was it is spam prevention something that's challenging to accomplish effectively? And was it that the centralized servers like AOL and Google and Yahoo, were they just much more effective and had the resources to actually deal with this problem better?
Yeah, well, so there were a variety of techniques that were used over the years. And, this became a cat and mouse game, right? You know, between the spammers and the email server operators, you know, trying to keep the signal to noise ratio for all of their end users relatively high. So, you know, what was one of the... Really, one of the first things that happened was the email server operator stopped. They turned off, you know, open relay policies. They said, we're no longer going to relay, you know, stuff to other servers. Mm-hmm. We're only going to worry about accepting emails for our own domain, basically. Mm-hmm. That worked for a very short period of time. But then, you know, they realized they needed to start figuring out a way to reject email. And the problem here was actually that this was in direct conflict with really the primary goal and architecture of email as a protocol, which is message reliability. Mm-hmm. So they started, there were some changes to the protocol to, you know, add some codes around, you know, your email's been rejected, you know, temporarily or permanently or whatever. The specifics of how and why you might reject that could be pretty arbitrary. And so one of the first things that we saw instituted in, I believe, the mid to late 90s was this idea of content filtering. You may have heard of things like Bayesian filters, which was Spam Assassin was a really popular piece of software that did that. And really the idea around that is, you know, we look at all the spam that's happening and we look for patterns, and then we essentially have kind of like regular expressions. You know, we're looking for patterns in the content that and then we essentially score the content of the email that's coming in.
Like how close is it?
And if it's above a certain threshold, we say this is probably spam.
Right.
It is unwanted. And you know, that kind of worked, but it also had a lot of false positives. So now we started having non-spam emails getting flagged as spam, which was causing the opposite problem.
Right.
But or it was still causing a problem with the signal to noise ratio. There's the signal was not always getting through.
In a protocol where the deliverability is supposed to be one of the most important parts.
Yep. But you know, the protocol has no concept of spam or of, you know, desired versus undesired messaging.
So I think that's actually makes me think, like, how does one define spam? Is there a sort of widely regarded open standard between the major mail providers? Like, this fits the definition of spam? Obviously, it's quite complex, I'm sure, but just like in general, is there a...
Right. You know, well, it's subjective and arbitrary, but, you know, the definition of spam is an unwanted message.
Right.
And so there is no like technical definition for that other than like a human telling you, I did not ask for and I did not want this
right.
message. So, you know, what happened after content filtering kind of petered out as being a worthwhile anti-spam measure? Well, it really turned into reputation, and reputation, you know, can be kind of qualified in a number of different ways. But one of them was, you know, IP address reputation is like, we're going to look at all of the email coming from your IP address. And if the content is always looking spammy, or if our users are giving us feedback that there's a lot of spam, then we're going to start to consider everything from your IP address to be spam and essentially black hole it, you know, and not accept it.
All right. And now we're getting to that point where it's no longer permissionless. It's censorship, and the individual mail providers are sort of playing dictator in that way on what is allowed to get through to the other side, the intended message recipient, and what isn't.
Yeah. But the thing is, a lot of the solutions to spam were actually developed as like third party businesses. So all of these email reputation businesses sprang into existence.
Mm-hmm.
Things where they were operating blacklists that you could essentially subscribe to, where, you know, the idea is this company is listening to a lot of the email, you know, feedback for other email operators and aggregating it all together and creating and managing their own blacklists. There's various like sender reputation services that you can, you know, opt into and do things to, you know, configure aspects of your email so that it will be considered less spammy. But essentially, you know, what we're talking about is gatekeeping is what's starting to happening. And it's like the cost of doing all of these things is also rising, which is continuing to price out smaller players from being able to effectively use email.
Do you think it was a mistake that the spam prevention measures were taken sort of off protocol and done by private independent third parties?
Yes, in the sense that it opened it up to being very arbitrary, and also, you know, imposed a lot of cost. You know, part of the problem is that everyone was looking at this as a recipient problem, or as a problem for the ISPs or the ESPs, the email service providers.
Yeah.
And that's what I worked for, was an email service provider. So, you know, at my company, we were really more on the sending side, and we had thousands of clients sending many, many millions of emails through our infrastructure every day. And our job was to do everything humanly possible to ensure the deliverability of those messages, which, if you kind of think about it, is kind of ridiculous because the protocol itself is supposed to ensure deliverability. But what happened was all of these walls and really the gatekeeping by the big players, the tech giants and ISPs and the reputation services were what started causing problems for our clients, who were mostly, you know, online retail, you know, trying to market and sell stuff to people. And that's an especially big gray area, right? You're trying to sell stuff to people. And then, you know, we were trying to help our clients be able to navigate, you know, both the legal and the technical aspects of how can you send sales and marketing messages that are wanted, you know, so they're not considered that they're not considered spam by the people who receive them. And more importantly, they're not considered spam by the intermediaries who are needed to approve and relay the messages to get to the recipient.
Right. This, as you're saying, it makes me think of Nostr in some ways today, where the relays, there's so many of the free and open relays today, but there's already a developing a market for these paid relays. It seems like a similar problem is sort of.
It's absolutely going to be the exact same problem, and I wrote a whole article about this recently. Well, we have the solution, which is great. We had a theoretical solution in 1997, I guess. The solution is to flip the cost problem away from the recipients and onto the senders.
The ones who are doing the spam.
Yes. Because when you can impose a cost upon sending the message, you're turning it from this arbitrary categorization problem, which is what leads people down the road of like looking at content or creating the idea of reputation. Mm-hmm. And when you go down the reputation aspect, that's when it turns into permissioned, you know, gatekeeping of right. having to prove yourself to be an honest player. So if you flip it on its head and you impose an economic cost on the sender, then you're really saying this sender believes that, you know, whatever they're doing and what the message that they're sending is worth, you know, some amount of value to right. be able to do this. Now, the solution in 1997, Adam Back, Hashcash, that was actually a protocol level improvement that he was recommending, where you were literally adding just a small amount of data, like one extra header to the email itself, you know, probably like 100 bytes of data. And that data would do a few things, but it would basically say and prove mathematically that I, the sender, have expended a certain amount of CPU cycles and, you know, electricity and value and resources in order to send this message. And that in and of itself also greatly decreases like the volume of messages that any one sender can send out, because mm-hmm. you're creating this bottleneck and resource cost.
So because I know Adam Back's quite influential in Bitcoin and it was quoted in the white paper, but having that be a obvious problem that existed then and having the solution presented some 20 something years ago, like why did that not really get adopted into the mail protocol?
I think at least part of it was a network effect and migration problem. You can almost look at it as a hard fork versus soft fork problem, right? Is like if you wanted, at least as far as I've thought about it, if you wanted to implement Hashcash, then you, in order for it to actually work, you would have to start rejecting messages that didn't have a valid Hashcash header.
Okay.
Now, Hashcash was, to be clear, it was implemented in Spam Assassin. And so that was done in a soft fork or backwards compatible way, where if you have a valid Hashcash header, Spam Assassin would give you a negative score. It would say, oh, this looks less spammy. So it wasn't a black and white thing. Uh-huh. But like I said, most email providers stopped using they stopped using Spam Assassin and content-based filtering in general for reputation. And now more often, it's less about the content and it's more about actually user action and engagement that is used to decide what is spam.
Like how they like how they're clicking, where they're dragging their mouse.
Yeah, yeah. And feedback
even more from the user. Info.
And so basically, you know, it would have been very hard to get consensus for every email user, even by the late 90s, you know, we're talking about millions of email users and clients and servers. To get them all to agree to implement that. Basically, the email as a protocol had ossified by then.
It's too late.
We've discussed quite a few negatives. I mean, the obvious of using a centralized email service is the convenience and so forth. We've discussed a few of the cons, which would be the ability to not have permissionless email, or sort of like the man in the middle that's making sure. But then the pros would being the reliability of it. What are some other maybe less obvious drawbacks or positives to using a centralized mail server versus running one on your own, if that's even possible today?
Yeah, today, I mean, it is theoretically possible, but it's such a high cost to be able to follow all of the other rules that have been developed outside of the protocol itself. You know, this is why entire companies exist, to help people with that. I myself have never run my own personal email server, because if you don't have a team of experts doing it, it's way too much of a time suck. These days, you can run the server and you can send a message from it, and it might even work for a little while, but it's basically guaranteed that you're going to get blacklisted at some point, and possibly not even due to your own actions. It could potentially even be due to actions of people with, you know, an IP address in the same range as yours. There's a lot of other things that have happened. Like, for example, a lot of email providers or even ISPs will block port 25. And the reason, and that's the SMTP port. And the reason for that is that, one of the other things that spammers did in the early days, they started writing malware to run and infect everybody's computer and send email directly from those computers. So when the ISPs had to deal with that, what did they do? Well, they just blocked all the traffic from all residential connections that were trying to send email.
I noticed that because I set up a Google Cloud server and it wouldn't let me open because I tried to run my own mail server and I was like, nope.
Yeah.
That's actually what sort of led me down this thought of wanting to have this conversation with you, is that I've been using Gmail for my, you know, podcast email. And I was like, well, it would look way more official if I had, like, you know, my own email domain, kind of like you have. So, I mean, you have app@lop.net. So how do you, if you're not running your own mail server, how does one still get that, you know, identity, if you will, even though, and maybe could you explain the difference between having something that looks like, you know, that's identified and branded as your mail server versus actually running your own mail server?
Right. So, basically you can set up DNS records, MX records, basically, for that say, you know, I own this domain. And by the way, the mail servers that handle email for this domain, incoming this emails, these are the IP addresses of those email servers. Okay. And, you know, all of that, like you said, it can look good, but from a like personal sovereignty perspective, it's all third parties all the way down. Like the domain name system is third parties and controlled by ICANN, which is controlled by government entities.
But it wasn't supposed to be this way, right? Like, this was not the initial vision of the mail protocol, I to my understanding.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the idea of an internet protocol is that anyone who follows the technical specification of the internet protocol should receive the guarantees that that protocol provides.
Right.
And that's really what we're talking about now, is all of these other meta rules that have been slapped on top of the email protocol over a very long period of time, decades, that have crippled the underlying protocol to the point that it actually no longer works.
So it's like, it's not even really a protocol in the same way that we would look at Bitcoin's rules as a protocol, right? Because if you, as Bitcoiners, like, if you fit the rules, it works.
Yeah.
But this is not not the case anymore. Were there, I mean, other than the just slow and steady, you know, shift towards centralization, which just maybe it's due to laziness or lack of education or lack of a reason. Other than that, like, what do you think were some major, perhaps mistakes or sort of things that led us to get here in the development of eVail over the last 20, 25 years? The critical junctions that we crossed that maybe affected the outcome later on?
Yeah, I mean, there was no one single decision, and there was, it wasn't a conspiracy. It wasn't result of some authority coming in. Really, it was a matter of incentives and people choosing the sort of naive, easiest solution for stuff.
So they were looking out for their own individual incentives, or like their, what's the, but isn't Bitcoin governed in that, with that same sort of game theory, like looking out for yourself somehow makes the whole system work. The protocol sort of expects you to be selfish in a way.
In a number of different ways, yes. Like that's why you know Bitcoin has survived for so long, is because the incentives are pretty well aligned.
Right.
But not in every way, though. You know, the incentives, I would say, like from a self-sovereignty perspective, the incentives in Bitcoin are not as perfectly aligned as I would like, and we can already see plenty of examples of that. Mm-hmm. And really, the biggest one is just the fact that the vast majority of people are acquiring their Bitcoin through a trusted third party, and then the default path, and then the default next step is nothing, and they just leave it with that trusted third party.
Right, and that to me is analogous to using a mail server that somebody else is running.
Yep.
Sure, you may get your Bitcoin most of the time, or when somebody sends a deposit to your address, normally you'll probably get it. But what if that provider decides, oh no, this isn't fit, this doesn't work?
Yeah, pretty much. So, you know, if you, in an optimal environment, if you were running your own email server, then it should not be possible for you to be deplatformed, right? You're sovereign as long as you have an internet connection, which, you know, that even alone, the ISPs themselves. But I mean, I've set up, you know, multiple redundant ISPs just for that reason. But now, you know, with both like your Gmail account or your Coinbase account or whatever, if you do the wrong thing, or you don't do the right thing, or you're even just like living in the wrong place, you know, any number of arbitrary things that you do or do not do may result in you being disenfranchised, your account shut down, you no longer have access to your email or to your money or whatever. It's really the same type of problem.
Right. And so when you're using Bitcoin in this custodial way, you're essentially taking a step backwards in a way, and or you're going, the email problems that were already figured out, where you're kind of going backwards and not learning from those mistakes that were made. Have we already started making, I mean, clearly it sounds like we need to be cautious and quite alert about this, because it sounds like we're heading, or at least we could be heading down the wrong path when it comes to Bitcoin and the protocol development. I mean, it's still early, right? We're less than 15, or basically 15 years in. And part of what sparked the nature of this conversation was that I'm worried that if we don't take action sooner, this is that critical juncture in time where it could be co-opted, where if you know, 5 to 10 years from now, people are still by most cases using Coinbase as their wallet, mm-hmm. not using self-custody. I fear that it may too be compromised in a protocol level, especially once it becomes ossified.
Right. So there's a big problem, which is convenience. Like, we have to assume that the vast majority of people will take the path of least resistance, the most convenient path. Right. And so that's why right now it's actually, I believe, a problem that people get. They get onboarded through, you know, not only centralized custodians, but through the AML KYC regime, which greatly, you know, increases your deplatforming risk. And there are certainly risks lower in the protocol. Like if we look at it from a scaling perspective, an optimistic take is that the scaling wars were actually quite reminiscent of some of the email scaling history, where you know, one of the big problems, the centralization that happened with email and the ecosystem of email providers, was the fact that higher and higher costs were getting loaded onto the email server operators, essentially the folks handling the receiving mm-hmm. and processing of all of this email.
Right.
There's a nearly perfect parallel with the Bitcoin scaling debates, where a lot of the big companies, really the custodial exchanges mostly, right, in Bitcoin, what did they say? They were saying, we're having to deal with a higher load of sending and receiving Bitcoin, and because the block size is constrained, it's creating a lot more.
So they wanted bigger blocks.
So they wanted bigger blocks, and they wanted to increase the cost and the load for running a full node, because that would have decreased their cost around like development and maintenance and using the protocol more efficiently.
Mm.
And you know, the Bitcoin ecosystem fought back against that.
Right.
And because of the incentives and the way that Bitcoin as a protocol works, it was able to fend off that, you know, you could call it an attack. Some people consider it an upgrade. You know, it's a matter of perspective, but right, from what we're talking about, it would have been an attack on the sovereignty of being able to operate as your own entity on the Bitcoin network.
Right.
So I believe that from that perspective, Bitcoin as a protocol has stronger game theory around, you know, selfishness potentially making it more robust against what we have seen happen with email. But there still is this commercialization aspect of the use of the protocol. And so this is why, I mean, for over 8 years, my focus has been on making self-custody easier, because it's not the default. And unless it gets easier and easier, you know, fewer and fewer relative like percentage of people who come in through these custodians are going to even be interested in taking on the challenge and, you know, the responsibility of self-custody. And, you know, there's also just additional cost around the, you know, the complexity of using the protocol on a regular basis, which the centralized providers have a much easier time of, because they get to hide all of that stuff under the hood.
Right. And extract it away, yeah.
Pretty much. So it's a very interesting ongoing battle, you know, for the sovereignty of people in this space.
And it sounds to me that you believe that we're still very much in that critical point of the battle for sovereignty for Bitcoin's protocol development. Like we may have won we may have won the block size wars battle, which when you explain it like that seems encouraging, rather than have succumbed to that centralized pressure. But it also sounds like that is not the okay.
We're not done.
Can't hang up our caps and call it a day.
No. So, you know, in 2017, you know, when we finally got segregated witness, soft fork activated, that opened up a whole new slew of possibilities. And, you know, now in the 5-6 years since then, you know, we start to see Lightning and even other protocols on top of Bitcoin being developed, which right, have been spurred by that. And you know, one of the concerning things is I certainly, especially with some of the recent drama around inscriptions and stuff, I see concerning black and white kind of judgment and behavior about protocol changes. Basically, people saying we need to ossify the protocol and never change it again. Mm-hmm. Now, from one perspective, that can be a good thing because it gives everyone some assurance that you use Bitcoin as it is right now, and no one's gonna rug you by changing the protocol and breaking stuff. But the flip side of that, which actually takes us back to 1997 with Hashcash, imagine if Hashcash had actually gotten merged into the email protocol, and how everything might have changed and gone very differently over the next 20 years. So my point being that we should not blindly exclude all possibilities of protocol changes, because there very well may be protocol changes out there that will actually increase sovereignty. And, at a very high level, one example of that is if we want Bitcoin to go mainstream and we want a billion people or billions of people to be sovereign Bitcoin holders, they need to have their own UTXOs, or we need to have new protocols for UTXO sharing that don't exist right now. And the only way currently that I see forward will require protocol changes to enable that type of stuff. So otherwise, if we ossify the Bitcoin protocol right now, the only way that I see Bitcoin adoption growing by orders of magnitude is if more people come into centralized custodians and just leave all their money with the third party. And what are we doing? We're essentially recreating the traditional banking system.
With less privacy, because everything is publicly broadcast. Huh. And so, I mean, is there this sort of, it sounds, is there like some lessons that can be learned from the way that email's developed here to make sure that we can sort of track our progress against as we go through the next 10 to, 5 to 10 to 15 years, and Bitcoin does sort of become ossified? Because I imagine it will eventually get to that point. If people are calling for it now, they've been calling for it. It's becoming more likely.
Yeah, I mean, I think pretty much everyone agrees that ossification is a natural process of all internet protocols. It's simply a function of like friction, and the larger a network gets, the harder it is to change it.
Right. And when there's implicit monetary incentives in it too, it makes it even harder to change it.
So, what is the lesson? I mean, I think there's no one specific rule that we can say, oh, as long as we don't let this happen, we'll be fine. Rather, I believe the lesson is actually instilling the culture of valuing sovereignty. And so that is where, you said, well, very early on, you were like, well, wasn't email all about being able to send messages reliably? Yes, but I don't believe there was ever a culture of everyone should be able to run their own email server. I don't think that was ever a value. And so as a result, it was very easy for it to be corporatized. And once you corporatize it, the incentives are completely different. And like the willingness to impose costs in various places become very different.
Something as I must imagine is because it's something as rudimentary as money. There's more skin in the game. Like maybe not everyone is involved is so passionate about the sovereignty of their email or communications. Some people maybe just don't. But the money touches darn near every aspect of life. Do you think that perhaps is why, or do you have another idea of why that may be the case? Why are people more focused on sovereignty, and why did that element of sovereignty come about in the Bitcoin world where it maybe didn't in the email world?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is naturally a touchier and more political subject. And of course, money has been around for a long time, and we have countless examples of ways that authorities have screwed with money. There is a lot more historical knowledge and learning, I think, that can be applied there, whereas, new message networks were not really a thing. Like, traditionally, message networks had always been just about, like, physically somebody carrying a piece of mail from one place to another.
Right. And I guess, like, I'm trying to put myself in the situation of somebody in the 90s who's in business, and what you were operating before was much slower, much less efficient, much less effective, right? The guy was, you said the guy that did the first spam made a killing on it. Mm-hmm. So at that moment, it seemed probably like the trade-offs of the convenience were far outweighed the negatives of the path that it may lead people down. How do we know if we're on that path today in Bitcoin? And are there ways that we can measure, like, is it a number of coins held on exchanges increasing or decreasing?
Oh, yeah, there's
like,
a lot of things can we look at? There's a lot of metrics we can look at. Now, of course, you know, this is a pseudonymous network, so we can't say, you know, exactly this number of people do this thing, but we can get some rough metrics around, well, we know somewhere in the range of 15 to 50,000 nodes are being operated out there. You know, some people probably run multiple nodes like myself. We can do some rough on-chain analytics and say, you know, this percentage of total Bitcoin is held by like known custodian third parties. And then we can kind of hope that that means that the rest of it is more widely dispersed amongst individuals. So yeah, there's stuff that we can definitely keep tracking, and you know, that's also what I've been doing since 2014 with some of the services that I've been running. But it's just about vigilance. And so, you know, if you see something that looks like it's trending in a concerning direction, then you have to start yelling and hope that you can get some people to come together to say, yes, we agree that this is a problem, and you know, let's work on a solution.
Yeah, the Bitcoin community is the most passionate group of people about a specific idea that I've ever seen. Them and the environmentalists that glue their hands to the stuff. That's like the polar opposites, but that's the dedication we need to fight. So I wonder if you think like they're, as we just naturally gravitate more people into the ecosystem as it hits more and more aspects of life, if you think that if left on its own accord, like we don't take the vigilance, right, we just kind of let it go, mm-hmm. and let it do its thing, like are we sort of trending in the right direction right now, or are we sort of trending against the sovereignty direction, like if we don't take action?
I mean, a little bit of both. You know, we've done well on the, you know, minimizing the cost of running a full node. It would be far worse if any of the other scaling proposals had gone through.
Like if the block sizes were larger, it would be much, much harder, more expensive,
yep.
to run a full node, which hurts the distribution of the network, right?
Yeah. You know, I think that the thing that I'm most worried about is just the general pace of protocol development, where I guess at this point it has been several years since Taproot was activated, and we don't really have any other changes on kind of up, you know, for being implemented and activated.
It was 2021.
Yeah, yeah.
We got inscriptions. That was enabled by Taproot, right?
It was, yeah. And you know, and people will continue building stuff, you know, that doesn't require consensus changes. But it's the moving forward with more protocol improvements, you know, at some pace. Like, I want to at least see something every few years. You know, otherwise, it gets longer and longer and longer. And you know, the longer it has been since the last consensus change, the, I guess, stronger the ossification proponents will become.
Right. At the same time, I hear people criticizing the use of Taproot for inscriptions and ordinals. I don't claim to understand like the technical aspect of that stuff well. But to my understanding, it is similar, this sort of shared abstraction. It reminds me of the third-party tools that are coming about from email long ago that aren't part of the protocol, where it sort of exists in its own little rule set. And as long as people agree to operate it, it's not necessarily part of the protocol. Is that like, and you don't have to have a fully formed opinion about this, but it, Like, do you think these sort of abstractions that are away from the protocol, like inscriptions, which are really being categorized on, you know, ordinals.com, for example, like, are those the types of things that we need to be careful about, or is that totally fine? Or is it too soon to tell even?
I think that any protocol that is sufficiently complex, or even really what it is any protocol that has its own programming language, which Bitcoin does, will inevitably result in some savvy developers hacking, quote unquote, unintended or unforeseen functionality into it. That should be kind of a given.
Okay.
Now, I don't think that it harms Bitcoin. If anything, I think it's interesting to see people experiment with.
They're paying the fee. They're paying the fee. Like, the cost is on the sender of that spam. If people are saying it's spam, it's like, well, they are paying the fees.
Yeah, so this is also a much larger debate and interesting historical question around quote-unquote Bitcoin maximalism, because really the original stance, I would say, of Bitcoin maximalism was that everything will inevitably be built on top of Bitcoin. Hmm. Now, it's a very vague, you know,
right. Everything thing. Is a wide, wide range.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think what we've seen with some of the drama is that there will always be some people who are upset with how some things are built on top of Bitcoin. But, you know, that is also the permissionless nature of the protocol, is that you, thankfully, you don't have to ask for permission, at least as we're standing right now. As long as you follow the rules of the protocol, you can be as creative as you want.
So, with that, we'll wrap by what are a couple things that people who are passionate about Bitcoin succeeding and want it to develop and not suffer the same fate of the email protocol, what are some things that they can do to participate and help strengthen the network from that sort of centralization over time?
I always tell people to, you know, leverage the skills that you already have. I feel like a lot of people come into the space and they're like, oh, I'm not technical, therefore I can't contribute to Bitcoin. And that's absolutely false. Right. You know, if you're a good communicator, you can contribute by helping to, you know, disseminate knowledge, by helping to distill values into memes that spread more quickly than having
just
to
make memes.
Yeah, I mean, memes can be interesting, and we could have a whole other, you know, episode about memetics within Bitcoin and some of the weird things that have resulted. But it's like I said, I think the best defense of all of this is just vigilance and awareness and values. And especially as Bitcoin goes mainstream, I don't expect that culture and those values will scale at the same way, but I also don't think they have to. I think with the game theory and the way that the protocol and network are set up, if anyone who wants to participate generally can, you know, we try to make the cost of participating in various ways as low as possible. But anyone who cares enough to devote the time and resources to participate, there's no gatekeeper that will stop them from doing so. So once you have decided that you want to participate in different ways, whether it's by running a node, whether it's by you know, participating in discussions, or maybe even helping with development, you know, that is helping to, you know, grow the network and make it even more robust and anti-fragile. So if you then become an advocate and you start orange pilling friends and family, you know, that just grows the network effect and makes it even more robust.
Right. Just because it's a technology and internet protocol doesn't mean the only way that you can contribute to it, it is through coding.
Yep.
There's a whole world out there that money will touch every aspect. Money already does touch every aspect of life. And if Bitcoin is money, and believe it'll become the world's reserve money someday, then it too will touch every aspect of it. So, well, thank you for coming on and pontificating. See, I fit it in about the history of email and the future of Bitcoin. And we will do our part together to make sure we keep it decentralized, right?
You bet. It's up to all of us.
There you go. Wise words from Mr. Jameson Lott. Thanks for going on.
Thanks for having me.